At the start of this side, there might be some repetition from side A.
There is no doubt about it, and there is no way of expediting it either, for the simple reason that the slowest of the processes is the survey.
But I have a feeling that all along our government hasn't spent enough money on the survey department. You have to have more staff.
Well, at that stage, our development was rather slow, you see. And possibly the staff available at that time was all right. Now there are various forms of surveys taking place, you see. Block surveys for settlements, other surveys for engineering surveys for irrigation, surveys for town planning, surveys for acquisition. I mean, there are so many branches of surveying done for various departmental purposes that one can't think of any particular giving preference to any particular thing, you see. Now there are certain areas where, you see, now in the Buttala Vadirata Korle, where I worked when I first joined in 1938 and was almost killed by a wild elephant, you see, there were vast extents of huge forests, you see, with just pockets of settlements where 3-4 families live, you see. I mean, what's the use of you trying to give an acre there or something like that, you see? You tell the fellows, now what is your village? Comprises 20 acres. Well, how do you want this divided? You see? 3 families. You see? 20 individuals or 15 individuals. You see? And 20 acres. Well, how do you want it? You just plan it out yourself. I mean, we are prepared to do what you want.
Now, I was wondering whether Mr. D.S.A. Nayaka realized how crucial the survey department was. And the moment they started backsliding, all sorts of complications would arise.
No, they never did backslide, if I may say so. If I may pay a compliment. The survey department, quite apart from the very accurate surveys they carried out, complied with every wish of Mr. D.S.A. and I, while it was under European management. While the head was a European. I've known of various people, now I remember during my time, Woodhouse, King, Johnston, Thornhill, yes, various people like that. They carried out whatever the Minister of Agriculture and Lands wanted, to the very letter. And if they said they would complete a survey of a certain area by a certain date, they ensured that it was done. In fact, I had the highest regard for the survey department, of all the other departments of that ministry, where I happened to be secretary at that time.
Wasn't it possible for some of the big bugs who wished to grab land, or, you know, some people who were up to nefarious activities, to get around one or two of the individual surveyors when they came on the first visit and get them to include a small plot of cultivated land within their claim so that they could use that as a basis, you know, to support their larger claims?
It is not possible in a village, you see. In a village, you see, that is also perhaps a national failing of ours. If you have a daughter who has run away with a man in the village, it will take only 10 minutes for the whole village to know that it has happened. Similarly, if the surveyor includes that, you see, the talk will go wrong. And mind you, the surveyor can't do it. He has to go with the village headman, you see. And if they are up to any activities like that, you see, they must be prepared for the consequences as well. You see, they may be sacked for that, for a thing like that. The village headman will be questioned. We go there. You know, we don't hold these inquiries privately, you see. A camp is, a tent is there. And the whole village is summoned. All the claimants are summoned for 9 o'clock. And you know, when it's like a car, if you take a new car and stop it in a village, you know the number of people that gather around the car. And they know when a tent is pitched and a settlement officer comes, that this is their most precious possession, their land. And the whole village is there. And you see, in the old days we had interpreters. That practice was carried on even when we went. Interpreter meant a clerk, you see, and we asked the questions in English. Although we knew our Sinhalese, we did that on purpose. Firstly, to find out how he interpreted it. Secondly, what reply the man gave back, which was interpreted to us in English by the interpreter. But all the time, we knew what the man was saying. We could have asked the question direct from him. But it was much better to get it that way, we found. You see? Because when we found that he was trying to evade a question or something, you see, we suddenly put a question to him in Sinhalese, you see, which brought him to his senses at once. You see, he originally came with the intention that our knowledge of Sinhalese was poor, and therefore he could get around the interpreter. Very often you had to watch the interpreter, you see. I know of a classic case where a woman came one day and handed a letter to me. You see, that was quite a common practice. It was generally a petition saying that so and so has grabbed her land, or that she was married and that the man has left her and that she is left with nothing and asking for some land or something like that. So I thought it was that. I opened it. I found she had put five 10-rupee notes in that. You see, now I never did anything there. You see, always the interpreter was there and always the village headman was there, at least. You see, and generally when at an inquiry you find 10-15 people always gathered. But she watched me, you see, when I had dispersed the crowd and I was attending to my office work, you see. The tapol and various, looking into various claims and things, she came up and gave. So that really only I and the interpreter and the peon were there. So I opened this. I found these 5-10 rupee notes. So I asked her what this was. Then she said, "No, sir, I have a land. It is under the settlement notice. And I want this settled on me." I said, "Well, I am here for that. What is this?" I said. You see, she had no answer. I said, I gave it back to her and said, "You thank your stars you are a woman. Otherwise, I would hand you over to the police. Now that you have brought this to me, it is in the nature of a bribe. And I will go into your claim doubly carefully to ensure, firstly, that you haven't come to me in the hope that I will take this and give you something more. Secondly, that there is no hanky-panky about your settlement. You take this back. And of course, tomorrow morning, when the village headman comes, I'll make it a point to tell him that you came at this time and handed me this money. You see, that had a salutary effect, because I had a feeling that either in the past, I certainly don't think that during my time anyone, my contemporaries were people like Winston Vijayakoon, who is now ambassador in Rome, V.S.M. de Mille, Carlton Correa, Ingledow, E.F. Marshall, Sir Eric Jans was the settlement officer, then Van Dort, S.L. de Silva, who is now the settlement officer, R.W. Tenhorn, who is chairman of the Industrial Credit Corporation, people like that who never stooped to such a thing. But I couldn't say that of all the interpreters, you see. I mean, it may be very well that they, you see, with Europeans who didn't know their language well, were able to diddle them, you see.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the sort of general impression I got.
What about the headman? Diddling the European officers and trying to diddle yours?
Well, he didn't have much opportunity of doing that with us. You see, because, you see, this was like an open court, you see, where 100 people are present and you ask a person, is this your cultivation? He says, yes. When did you come into the village? He gives the date. When did you start the cultivation? He gives the date. How old is the cultivation? You give the date. You check up with the field book. You see? And you ask your question so loud, you get the interpreter to talk loudly, that 100 people of the village are present. And if there is anyone to say a thing, he would say so without hesitation. And there is also the village headman, who is generally frightened that he has kept quiet, because there have been occasions where I pulled up the village headman for keeping quiet when he knew that the facts the man was relating were incorrect. But before the village headman could start or do a thing about it, you find some villagers say, "Ane hamdurone ehema nevey, meka mage idama, me miniha evilla va mava pannala dala aragena idama aragena wawanda da." Then you turn around, you find two or three people collaborating his statement. Then you turn to the village headman, ask him what is the correct situation. You see, and like that you can get any amount of evidence, you see. And that is not evidence that, you see, you require a lawyer to lead or anything like that, you see.
Now I was wondering whether there were opportunities for a village headman who controlled the village, you know, and had thugs behind them to frame a child.
I should think that was rather rare, you see. Because at the time I dealt with settlement work in the 38-42 period, the villagers were as ignorant and as innocent as one could would like them to be, you see.
What areas did you largely have experience in?
Well, I mean, there was no special area. Now, for example, my first area I dealt with was a Topo area in the Buthala Vadirata Korli. Then I dealt with areas between Trincomalee and Anuradhapura, Horovaputana, that area. Then I dealt with areas in the Putlam district, but my main work was centered around Kurunegala district, you see, the Nikavarati area, then on the Ibbagamua road, all that road leading up to Dambulla area, and so on, you see. I also had work in Sabaragamua, certain regions in Sabaragamua and in Uwa.
You referred to land grabbers and you I think you indicated that headmen quite often acted as brokers or took the land for themselves. How general was that?
No, I don't think I said headmen took the land for themselves, because they had to be jolly careful, you see. Not headmen, you see. I would say these Rate Mahatmyas and people who control the headmen, you see. Their general mode of operation was to buy a piece of land from some poor villager, then institute partition action and go on expanding on that little by little, because this man can't afford any form of litigation.
And the other claimants could.
Yes. And you see, then build up his land, you see. You find, I found that in certain areas. But by and large, I think the Settlement Act itself did a lot of good to the villager, you see. And especially if you had a sympathetic and conscientious officer, you see, it did a world of good to them, because instead of having undivided property, they each got individual blocks with a crown grant, which was valid title against the whole world.
Now, with reference to your time and your contemporaries, both senior and junior, would you say that sympathy and conscientiousness was fairly common?
Well, you see, during my time, we also had a few Europeans. Ingledow was one of them. E.F. Marshall was another.
Well,
I believe they were quite conscientious about their work, particularly E.F. Marshall, who was a great social worker and who died in Ceylon, really.
Mm-hmm. Apart from Rate Mahatmyas, didn't proctors and notaries and lawyers also participate in this land grabbing, and also big landed proprietors?
Well, there were a few instances, you see, where people did this sort of thing, I mean. I wouldn't say that it was the general practice, you see, because, you see, they were, a proctor, for example, knew the law. He knew what the land settlement ordinance was. So if he did grab land, he would have first seen to it that it wouldn't have been come under a settlement notice for at least 10 years. Then started cultivating and made an effort to have the land cultivated, you see, by the time claims were called, so that he had a fair chance of getting his land. You see? By this I don't mean by any means that we rejected totally the claims of people who had bought land, you see, genuine or not. Well, I mean, if a man A was entitled to 50 acres in the village and he on his own went and sold it to another complete stranger from Mathura, a Mr. X, at 5 rupees an acre. And if I found that that was his entitlement, well, I had no alternative but to tell the man, well, look, it is Chena land. It is under settlement notice. You haven't developed it. Therefore, it is crown land. You are a complete outsider here. What interest have you here? You see? I suggest that you leave the land alone. Well, he would plead, sir, I paid 2,000 rupees to this man. Let me have something of this. Well, I say, all right, you can have 10 acres. And he is thoroughly pleased because he knows he gets perfect title for 10 acres.
Mm-hmm.
You see? And then I'm left with 40 acres to deal with, you see, which I may map out for some purpose.
To what extent did you find landlessness prevailing in the areas, in particular the northwestern province and Sabaradamo?
not to a large extent. You see, they had, all of them had land. But of course, when you, if you tried to meticulously divide it among the pedigree, you see, you found that the fraction that a man got may have been half an acre or quarter acre or something, which in a village is practically useless except for a residential house. So you tried to give him a little more if you could, you see, and, you know, it was, I don't know, personally I found that the problems were few and the work was pleasant, in the sense that I left it to them, you see. If a family said we had 25 acres, we are six of us, five of us are not residing. There's only one man who is residing here. We like the entire 25 acres settled on him. Although they are all six claimants before me, I certainly carried out their wishes, you see. There was no question of my trying to say, well, look, you are entitled to this, you must take it. You see, so long as they sign the agreement withdrawing their claim to the rest of the lands under the settlement notice, it didn't matter to me, and I only looked at it from the angle. I asked the six, well, where are you working? I'm a harbour labourer. Where are you working? I'm working at Lever Brothers. Where are you working? I'm on an estate, you see. Where are you working? I'm employed as in a hotel at this place. You see, so I am fairly certain. Are you all married? Yes. Where are your families? In our respective places of work, or in our respective areas. Who is this? This is our eldest brother. What is his family? Well, his wife is living with him. He has four children, grown-up children, you see. And we come here only once a year or once in 2 years. And we have really lost interest. And he is the one who is looking after all. We don't want it. Once they withdraw their claim and sign, there is no legal implication in it at all, you see.
To what extent do you think that estates in the vicinity of a village, as you know, as long as they hadn't encroached on a village area, help the villagers? Or was it generally detrimental?
I should have thought it rather detrimental, in the sense that for a glass, friend. In the sense that you see, the estate normally, you see, in my times would have employed Indian labour, which they could have got cheap for one thing, where. They would not have taken as much leave as local people would have. You see, they went to India perhaps once in 2 years or once in 3 years. And last not but least, were prepared to live in lines and under conditions which our people are firstly not accustomed to, secondly might think insanitary, and so on and so forth, you see.
No, but didn't the fact that the estate was in a vicinity help a village by giving them opportunity for part-time labor out of season and so on and so forth?
No. For this reason, that I believe, I'm not quite sure of this fact, but it is subject to your verification, that the rulers of this country had ensured at that time by legislation that under the Medical Wants Ordinance and various other enactments, that the local population did not benefit by those. And those who really benefited were these Indian families that were brought down for the purpose of cultivation.
But I was just thinking the mere fact of labor would give them some spending money and things like that.
Mm.
You know, part-time work on the estate would give them another source of income.
Well, while it would have given them a source of income, you can't forget that even the Indian laborer who has come down with his wife 10 years ago or 20 years ago is now having children, probably half a dozen of them, who are all majors and for whom there must be an outlet, you see. And the most logical and natural outlet is employment on the estate itself. I am not sure whether the labor laws provide for such a contingency. You might check that up, whether there is any obligation on the part of an estate to find employment for the sons and daughters, the progeny of the original employees. I believe there is some such thing. In any event, you see, for purposes of economy and so on, they find that they can, in a sense, give the sons and daughters of the employees there, you see, work at a much lower rate, in short, underemployment, you see, and get them to work, get as much work out of them as they could get out of a ordinary laborer, paying double that wage.
Mm-hmm. To take another aspect, chain of cultivation, you said that you considered it wasteful. Was that Mr. Diasenaika's opinion too?
It was.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering whether it was all that wasteful in the dry zone, in the sense that there weren't any other alternatives where there was no water.
Well, that is the point. You see, I was just thinking of this problem of water. Until the time Mr. D.S. Senanayake became Minister of Agriculture and Land, no serious attempt had been made to have any form of artificial irrigation works. The ancient systems did exist, and they were very effective. As a matter of fact, a village, when you talk of a village, you can't think of a village without a tank. Around the tank, below the bund, you find the paddy fields. And above the tank, and on the sides, you find the highland where the people live. That constitutes the normal village, you see. So that really, except for that form of village life, till Mr. D.S. Senanayake took things into his hand, no form of serious irrigation work was started, you see. His first scheme was the Minnaria scheme.
Mm-hmm.
Where you might possibly go to the library and try to find out whether you can get hold of these old Hansards dealing
yes.
with Mr. Senanayake's land policy and so on. But he had to fight a right royal battle to get many of these ordinances going, you see.
Mm-hmm. Now, with regard to chain of cultivation, now farmers who studied land use in the dry zone say that the wise concession to the laws of nature where there is no water, and that's the general feature of most of the dry zone. Because until successful modern methods of what is popularly called dry farming have been evolved.
I say, firstly, I must say this with due deference to farmers' own conclusions. You see, it is time after 20 years of independence at least that we evolved a system of dry zone cultivation by rotating our crops in such a fashion, you see, that the villager got the best use of it. Now, a system of rotation that Mr. Sen and I had in mind some time back was paddy, tobacco, onions, and a cycle like that, you see. So tell me. Hello.
I was wondering what the emphasis of Mr. Desenaiker's agrarian policies was. Now, you have explained something about the colonization schemes, and that I know.
Now, I didn't quite finish that portion about farmers' concept of this dry zone. Firstly, as I said, 20 years of independence, we should have evolved a system. Secondly, what we call the dry zone is a zone where we have 40 to 45 inches of rainfall within 3 months. So that really, with the evolution of a proper system of cultivation of this zone, it is also necessary that we should double our efforts in conserving this water that is far too much for that particular period. If by a system of tanks, channels, call it whatever you like, I mean lift irrigation, whatever it is, you can conserve this water to last you a longer period, stretch it, stagger it in some way, you see, and also evolve your this thing. And let the two go hand in hand. You see, by now, our dry zone should no longer be a dry zone as such. I mean, I am quite serious about what I say. You see, I mean, we talk in terms of dry zone when in places like Australia, the maximum rainfall is probably about 45 inches, you see. Of course, maybe that it doesn't fall within 2 to 3 months. Maybe that it is stretched over 9 to 10 months. But that is where we make the mistake, you see. One is the evolution of a proper system of rotation or cultivation. The other, which is the more important thing, is the conservation of the water that falls within this short period, you see, and goes to waste, you see, creating floods and various other problems. You see, where people's cultivation is affected, everything is affected, you see. So that really, I mean, now when you take the ancient cities of Ceylon, you see, coming down from Madhavacharya to almost Dambulla, you see, and from Trincomalee almost to the Chilao area, you find a vast system of tanks and channels, you see, which cover this dry zone. A civilization that existed 2,500 years ago, if it could have had such a system, I mean, it is amazing that with all this, after 2,500 years, with all what science has been able to discover and evolve, we are yet in the process of a dry zone when it should be a flourishing zone. Mm-hmm. You know,
thinking of Desenaiker's policies. Now, one branch of that, an important branch, was colonization schemes, which I take it were meant to relieve population pressure in one area, but also to boost food production. And
yes, that's correct. Yeah.
What other emphasis did he have? Now, for instance, I would like to know whether his emphasis was on a sort of small-scale peasant agriculture or large-scale farming.
Well, it was more peasant agriculture to start with, you see. Now, when he had the Mineria scheme in mind, of course, everyone was against it. Money was voted very grudgingly, and they said it was going to be a failure.
Everyone being the Europeans?
Generally speaking, you see, but even some of the Ceylonese did not take it as with any sort of sense of
hope
or responsibility, you see.
Even other ministers?
Well, some of them anyway. You see, but the first few deaths due to malaria and so on, there you are, didn't we tell you business, you see. But he pressed on with it. And now you find that quite a large number of them are income taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
You see, at that time, you see, he gave each percent he brought down from various areas like Kegal and various places like that, I believe. 5 acres of paddy land, and I believe 5 acres of highland. And they were provided with a cottage and planting material and this and that. And that was the same system adopted under the Parakrama Samudra scheme.
Mm.
But now, due to pressure of population, the extent of land given has been, I believe, reduced largely. You see, maybe 2 acres, or I don't know, you'll have to check those figures up. But still, I feel that we haven't made a systematic study of our, of our catchment areas, you see, and evolved our schemes in a way that we could still make use of all the water that now flows out into the seas through the rivers, causing vast damage during the various monsoons. I am inclined to the view that if we do conserve this water properly, if necessary, get expert opinion. There is no shame in that. I mean, after all, you think the other man be a bigger fool and ask him the most foolish questions. It's all right. Maybe our people are not experienced enough, you see. Get a first-class engineering survey of the whole of Ceylon. Divide our catchment areas. Evolve our schemes. Most of them are evolved, really, but they can be enlarged upon. You see, for example, the Minipe scheme was, I believe, a right bank scheme. There is no reason why they shouldn't have a left bank scheme, which would cover even a large area, you see. And as far as possible, couple this with industries, cottage industries and light industries, where these dams that are going to conserve this water could also be used as multi-purpose dams for purposes production of power. And I mean, after all, why shouldn't a villager have an electric light like this if he can help it?
People have totted up the cost of the colonization schemes and said that if the same cost was applied to, same money was applied to industrialization, it would have brought greater benefits and given as much employment. Of course, this is a retrospective position, but
you see, I would first start with his food. clothing next. His shelter first. Then his general well-being fourth. General well-being means his health and his education of his children and that sort of thing. You see, now that is one aspect of it. If you are very business-minded, then I would certainly say that what you say is possibly correct. That is, if we had devoted more of our resources to industrialization, there may have been a chance of our gaining foreign exchange, because we would have started in a very crude way, you see. I mean, but we would have improved. Now take like things like biscuits, Maliban biscuits. I mean, I should imagine they would compete with biscuits in any part of the world, you see. Or our cigarettes, you see, are possibly quite good. I mean, like that. But one mustn't forget this, that we neither had the raw material, nor had we the know-how to get about these things. And if we did employ others outside Ceylon, I don't think they would have been so very eager to teach us all the tricks of the trade, for one thing, and teach us the simplest, the quickest, and the cheapest way of doing it. You see? So it is rather problematic as to whether, in fact, if we did not lay emphasis on cultivation but on industry, whether we would have been better or worse. My personal view is that we have reached a stage now where extensive cultivation is not possible. Intensive cultivation is possible and should be done. You see, after all, it is pure arithmetic. If you say you are 50% self-sufficient in your paddy, with a yield of 50-fold, if by the use of better planting material, a better fertilizer mixture, better methods of cultivation, better equipment, you can increase that 100-fold. You see? Theoretically, isn't your problem solved? Mm-hmm. You see? Now you say that in Taiwan or some place, I heard it or read it somewhere, that they have evolved a seed that produces 250-fold. When I was with Mr. D.S. Senanayak, the average yield in 42 was in the region of about 28 to 30. And we were then approximately 38 to 41% self-sufficient. But today, 25 years later, our population has more than doubled. And our state of self-sufficiency is possibly nothing more than 55 to 60%. You see? That is partly because we haven't been using, you see, either modern methods or fertilizers, for which, of course, I agree that foreign exchange is necessary, you see, or used experts, or conserved our water properly. You see, there are so many factors involved in this thing, you see. Now, one may think of the Nginiagala scheme, which was which is, say, 10 years old. Today, if you are doing that, you would probably do it on a scale which will bring not 100,000 acres under cultivation, but probably 500,000.
Mm-hmm.
You see, your dam will be larger, your height of your dam would be larger, your production of electricity would be greater, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
You see, that is why someone told me the other day that, I say, when you build a house, you build it as cheaply as possible so that it won't last you more than 15 years. Because in 15 years, you'll have to knock it down and raise it 4 floors. Because there was a population problem will be so pressing that there will be no room. So there is no need for you to have a foundation laid, you see, which will carry your house for a century. You see, there is something in which what the man says. You see. I mean, after all, when you look at it that way, I don't know whether it's a sound economical proposition. But certainly what he says is, I say, if you live 15 years free, you see, and then at the end of 15 years your house is coming down, you probably will be able to get twice the value of the land and the house at that stage, if you care to sell it.
Coming back to Mr. the Serenaika, since you mentioned that his emphasis was on the peasant, I was wondering whether this was inspired by a kind of romantic attachment to the past, you see, and to the Sinhalese traditions, and to his own personal experience in the field, and also whether he had the other long-term view that peasantry with a secure title and with security in the land was the best safeguard against Marxist and communist influence.
No, I think it was the form.
Mm-hmm.
He himself hailed from a family of farmers. I remember once he took me to one of his estates. It was, now I forget the name, somewhere near Naramala. Coal Valley it was called. You see, then I was his secretary, we spent the day there. He took me round the estate, he was inspecting his estate. He turned round to me and said, Atu, do you see this block here? It's a block of 80 acres, he said. Well, the coconut tree is about 30, 40 years old. He said, every single tree here has been planted with my own hands. You see, I don't think this idea of communism and security against that was in his mind at all.
So one thing, I don't suppose the danger was evident at that stage.
No, I don't think the danger was evident, nor was he so narrow-minded to think of it in terms of security. You see, he was only interested in the general welfare of the peasant. You see, and the fact that under the foreign rule, you see, for a period of 250, I don't know, Portuguese, Dutch, English, the people, the general peasant of this country had a very broad deal.
Is now, for instance, the Land Development Ordinance, and the fact that people could mortgage the land and there were other restrictions with a view to saving them from their own improvidence. He favoured that ordinance, didn't he? And
yes.
Such objects.
Yes, yes, of course he did.
While admitting the good intentions, especially in the context of the past, I was wondering whether from a sort of modern viewpoint, this step can be challenged as something that is not practicable. Can you reform men
through such conditions? Can you make them less improvident by putting all these restrictions? Isn't it better to let the natural economic forces...
What are the less restrictions that you have in mind?
Outright ownership.
No, I think by and large,
perhaps providing...
You see, if I may talk of the Sinhalese community as such, you see, the ordinary man's first reaction is to own a bit of land. His second reaction is to put up a house of his own, you see, and so on. So that from that angle, I don't think that communal ownership, where cultivation went, would ever have helped it to the extent that it would have done with individual ownership.
Yes, I was not favoring communal methods as such. I was thinking that this, having this rather complicated land development ordinance, and ultimately all the infrastructure which they had to build in order just to enforce it, all these DLOs and so on and so forth. I wonder whether it was worthwhile, whether you could enforce it as you wish to enforce it, and B, whether it was wise in that you can't reform men just like that if they are going to be improvident and get into debt and lose the land. You have to let it happen. But there'll be others who will be improving the land anyway.
Who are the others you are referring
to? No, say some peasants might lose the land, true, if you give it to them. But others might stabilize their position.
No, I think by and large, I think the cases where the, if I may use the word, go astray or sell it off, and will be very few.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they sell it, it is not unlikely that they will sell it to their own kith and kin rather than to an outsider. You see?
Mm-hmm.
And that really will not matter so much, because the man who buys it will be a keen man who would like, instead of cultivating cultivating 5 acres, cultivate 10 acres.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm very interested in the land development ordinance, and I've studied the ordinance, and I've seen the land manual too. But in talking to officers today, I find that general opinion is that even the allottees, those who receive the land, don't like some of these conditions. Only one heir to be nominated, and can't mortgage it and things like that. And there's a demand to let them have it as a sort of complete freehold.
No, I wouldn't advocate that at this stage.
Mm-hmm.
You see, where it is crown land, I firmly believe that the nominee should be one. If I am the father of 8 children, and if I have an allotment of 3 acres, I don't think there is much point in 8 fellows grabbing the 3 acres, and they can't make much of it anyway. You see, it is much better that one have it, or at most 2 have it, and let the others get on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I mean, that is the whole problem, the crux of the problem today, as far as paddy cultivation goes. You see, we are held in so minute fractional shares you see, that a whole host of them are involved eventually. I don't think a family can take a couple of bushels of rice home.
Now the point I was getting at was that because it is somewhat unpopular and not liked by some of the roti, they do their best to evade the conditions. And now, for instance, they're not supposed to give the land out in Ande.
Yes.
But they do so. Not written down, but tacitly they do so. In colonies, over 50% of the paddy land is given out in Ande, which is against one of the intentions, at least, of the ordinance. Now, since this is happening because they don't like the conditions, I wonder whether you can work it. They're doing their best to evade the conditions. And it means eternal vigilance to enforce the conditions.
What is your solution to it? Can you think of a solution?
Well, the popular demand is that you give it in freehold.
Well, do you know the intention behind that?
Yes, the intention was to prevent it getting into the hands of this land.
No, the intention for the intention for this popular demand to get it as a freehold.
Yes.
The obvious thing is to sell it.
Yes.
You see, and sell it probably to an undesirable. You see, or someone who. Hello? You see, so that while I do admit that there may be certain difficulties, I can't think at the moment of a better way of dealing with it. The only suggestion I could make is that where they find that serious inroads are made into the rules and regulations governing the allocation of these lands, that the permits be cancelled and given to others.
It is a difficult question. But I was wondering whether Mr. D.S.A. himself felt that this might not be liked, but that it was nevertheless necessary and must be done because it's salutary. But I just the point that I'm.
Well, frankly, at his time, I don't think this problem arose in this major form in which it has been indicated to you by whoever you have had talks with. You see, because at that time his main efforts were concentrated on the villager. Now, with this massive food production drive that the Prime Minister has started, you see, any individual, I mean companies, farmers, anyone can get land. You see, and obviously in the process, you see, those who are not seriously intending to cultivate also go and get them in the rush, you see, and you can't blame the officers or anyone because their investigations have to be very casual, you see. I mean, the whole object is to plant the land, you see, if you waste 3 months in trying to find out who the man is and whether he is desirable or not, well, you miss the bus.
Now, the point that I was searching for was whether D.S., being a villager himself, realized that this was going against traditional concepts, you know, given, having one nominated heir is against Sinhalese tradition. And because of that, it would be unpopular.
It is rather difficult for me to say that. But he certainly was endeavoring to the best of his ability to do something about this fragmentation of land. You see? Which really brings in this question you have in mind.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so that I think if he was given his own way, he wouldn't have done, he would have done just the same.
Mm-hmm.
You see, after all, I say you can't expect, you see, you've got to take the whole thing, you've got to dovetail the whole thing together. Now we have started free education. We have Madhya Mahavidyalas and Mahavidyalas scattered all over the country, hundreds of them. We find that the village boys and girls are all attracted to these schools. We find that there is very good talent available. They all get through their GCE ordinary level. Some of them do extremely well. And what do? Immediately after that, you see, there's a beeline to all the urban